Accession number 18573, Reel 2.
Fred Vernard, Reel 2.
Well, one by one, we were ushered into the room. There was this sergeant sitting there, where you are sitting now, opposite me. And he had a Morse key there, which he was tapping away there, and asked me to repeat it. Of course, I didn't have a clue, so I just got hold of the thing and kept banging away like mad. "You'll do," he said. And that was it. That's how I finished to become a wireless operator. "You'll do."
What was the training like at on Sylt?
Well, it was very, very exhausting. We did 12 hours a day. Very intensive it was. We started at 8 o'clock in the morning till 8 o'clock at night. We had a break for an hour for lunch. There was no tea break. We had our tea when we finished at 8 at night. And there was continuous classes of about 25 of us, sitting like a schoolroom with the instructor front on the podium there, going away there. We had to write down exactly what he was transmitting over a loudspeaker that came. Morse code, in other words. We had to write down what he was transmitting. And every night, it was then checked over by him and marked. And that's how they sorted out the ones that were, as you might say, well, inclined to accept all this racket that was going on. Some were inclined to accept it better than others. And that's how they sorted them out. And the ones that actually, well, didn't make too many mistakes, they went on to the next class. And that's how they whittled them down. In the end, we finished up with 12 in the class. And the others were sent away. Where to, I don't know. They went back to some other unit, obviously. But there was 12 of us left. And after an intensive course of, I think it was 5 weeks, I couldn't be certain about that, about 5 weeks, we had an exam which consisted of writing down 100 words which he transmitted. We had to write down exactly what transmitted. And then it was marked. And he told us then, the sergeant, that people with the least mistakes will then be allowed to choose which branch of the Navy they want to go into. Anyway, you might guess what's coming now. I happen to be amongst the first three. And I thought, Scharnhorst, sounds good. Big, safe. So next day I was asked if I made up my mind I wanted to go, so I fancied the Scharnhorst. It was a few hours later, the very same chap came up, Unteroffizier, came up with a form, sign here, sir, if you want to go to the Scharnhorst. Of course, you weren't allowed to read the thing anyway, just sign, and that was it. So I signed. 2 days later, I finished up in Danzig, U-boat base. When I queried this, mind you, to be fair, the Scharnhorst was in Danzig at the time, but I finished up in the U-boat base. When I queried it, I was just told, you managed to receive 90 words a minute, which is required for a U-boat wireless operator. The Army required 60 words. U-boats, much quicker, for obvious reasons, radar and all this business, 90. Because I had happened to receive 90, we're not going to waste that on the Scharnhorst, they say. You're in U-boats. And that was it. So I was in U-boats.
So you were tricked.
That's what it amounts to. It was a con trick, yes. But I wouldn't have dared query it or do anything about it. I mean, it was obvious after the training we received in Eckernförde, the way they treated us, the discipline that was introduced, you wouldn't have dared query it anyway. But let me add, I subsequently was quite happy with it after a few weeks, because I spent two and a half to 3 weeks, I believe it was, on the Scharnhorst as part of my training, wireless operating training. I did not like it at all on the Scharnhorst. There were so many officers on there that had a crew of 1,800. There were so many officers and ratings there, and you spent all day saluting. I didn't like that.
In fact, some of the Royal Navy people I've interviewed have told me that they preferred submarine service because the discipline was less than in the big ships.
Comradeship on the submarine. I much preferred it. If I had the choice today, I'd go back on a submarine rather than a big ship.
So you were aboard Scharnhorst in Danzig?
In Danzig, yes. In fact, on the Scharnhorst, we were learning about transmitters, receivers, and all the rest of the equipment we were going to use on the submarine.
Was the Scharnhorst an impressive ship?
Very, very much so.
In what sense?
Well, for a start, it had 12 enormous guns, and that impressed us. It was also overwhelming. Everything was so big. It was very impressive. Forbidding, almost. All this metal everywhere. The sound when you were running along. All this, you know, sort of really forbidding. And having to sleep in hammocks, I didn't fancy that either. They were curled up. But that, not many did like it anyway. I wasn't the only one.
What was Danzig like as a naval base?
It was quite nice. We didn't get much time to go into town, because, as I mentioned previously, the training was all very, very, very intensive, right throughout my training. Because then, we're now getting on to 1942 by then. And by 1942, Dönitz, Admiral Dönitz as he was desperate to get more U-boats into service. Because Admiral Raeder, who was in charge of the Navy, he wanted surface ships. Bismarck, Scharnhorst, Tirpitz, ships like that. Which wasn't on the cards when you think about it. It took years to build those. Whereas submarine, they subsequently built in a week. So they were churning submarines out. And Dönitz got his way with Hitler in the end, and they built submarines. They churned them out. So they needed crew. So the training was more and more intensified, and that's what happened in Danzig. I had to go on what they called an underwater listening course. It was Aztec, which only lasted a fortnight, but again it was sort of 12 hours a day.
What did you think of the Aztec system they had in those days?
Not very efficient. It was, thinking about it now and having subsequently better equipment, it was hit and miss. Because I don't think we were trained sufficiently enough for the air to become accustomed to the sound, which was the important bit. I mean, we knew what we had to listen for, but the sound varied, and your ear wasn't trained for it already in that short time.
Was that because everything was too rushed?
Exactly. That's what it was, yes. The same applied to the diving course where to go on. I mean, normally to train a diver takes a long while. It didn't take us a long while. We had a week.
What happened on the diving course?
Well, basically, you had an instructor. They put the gear on you, you know, the helmet and everything else. You had an instructor. They explained to you what was happening, how you had to breathe, what you had to do. An instructor went down with you, came up with you, and you did that several times a day. You did that for a few days, and you were a diver. And that's it. Then...
Was this to learn how to effect repairs or to escape from
effect repairs, effect repairs. What that amounted to, on a submarine, everybody has more than one job. I was not just a wireless operator. I was the medico as well on board, because I happened to have a little bit of education as a dental chap. So I became a medico as well. And then you also have to have an inkling of being a seaman as well. So you know one or two knots, how to make knots, and if required, if somebody falls ill or is injured, you've got to go up on the bridge and be a lookout and all this sort of business. So you have to go through the whole of the training anyway. The only thing we did not do is become torpedo mechanics or engine mechanics or whatever. But as I said, we had several jobs each.
Was there any particular part of the courses that you're on that you liked or disliked?
Actually, I quite liked the diving. Not the diving in what we call the diving bell, the diving subsequently, which involved escaping from a submarine. That I did like that.
What was the method of escaping that you were taught?
Well, it was a huge tower, 100 foot high, full of water. It was in two sections. There was a 6 foot high chamber on the ground you went into. It was then closed airtight and flooded. You obviously had your mask on. It was flooded to equal the pressure, the water above. Then you opened the hatch when it was flooded. The pressure was then equal, and you opened the hatch, and you had to gradually float up and stop every few yards to equal the pressure on your lungs as you went up. Unfortunately, we lost a chap there in that exercise, and I'm told, I don't know how true, but I'm told they lost several throughout this period of training. What happened? The equipment we had, it was the cartridges to clean your air as you breathed out, was, I will remember it in a minute, a compound, if it comes in contact with water, it emits a gas, and therefore, obviously very dangerous. And this chap, what he did, as you went up, and you had to stop every so many yards to equal the pressure, only for a brief moment, you know, 10 seconds or whatever, to equal the pressure on your lungs, you had to let air out to stop. And the air you let out by, you had a mouthpiece in, just opening your lip, and the air just bubbled out. But obviously, he opened it a bit too much, and water came in. And as he breathed out, he pushed the water into the cartridge. I will remember it, perhaps later. And obviously he breathed in the gas, and before the instructors noticed what was going on, that was it. They're supposed to be watching everybody as they went up. But whether they did or not, I wouldn't know, but anyway, the poor chap floated up and that was it. They couldn't revive him. There was one we lost. We lost more on the training course.
You said parts of the training were connected with testing your nerve. What were those?
Well, I consider that to be all part of it. This diving business, if you kept your nerve. If you didn't keep your nerve, you let water in and you were a goner. As simple as that. To keep your nerve as you went in the bottom and the compartment was then flooded, while you stood in there, and you knew you had 100 feet of water above you. And the hatch is going to be open, and all this water above you, and you were down below. That was all part of, they assessed you, how you kept your nerve, if you kept calm, because you had monitors on you, you see. If you kept your nerve, that's what it amounts to.
What other? All this was taking place in Danzig?
Yes, yes, it was in Danzig, yes.
What other memories of Danzig have you got?
Going out with a crowd of seamen, our crew, meeting some girls, chatting them in the street, and years later being told by British intelligence what we told the girls.
How did that happen?
That I don't know. It just proves to me how on the ball British intelligence was.
Had you given them any useful information?
No, no, no. It was a question of you were just mucking around. But we did, later on our first trip out, we stopped in Stavanger in Norway. There we, on a marketplace, there were three girls that we were chatting to. We told them that we put into Stavanger the night before, and there was, I believe, the time was involved. British intelligence told me that in London at an interrogation camp, word for word.
You were already in a U-boat crew by then?
By then, yeah. From Danzig, I was sent to Bremen. Because I finished my diving training, I finished my wireless operator training, and my underwater listening training. I was then considered to be ready for the big jump. So I was sent to Bremen, which was not a U-boat base as such. They were building U-boats in Bremen. It was a, what do you call it? I don't know.
Shipyard, yeah.
A shipyard. I couldn't find the word. It was a shipyard. They built U-boats there. In fact, they built them there almost, you could say. They turned out so many there, on the conveyor belt almost. They got so geared up there, they were really building them quickly there. In Bremen, we had a really nice time, I thought. We were stationed at a hotel in Bremen. The shipyard was obviously further out, a few miles out, and we were transported in by tram to the shipyard. And doing that, every day when we got on the tram, the post office lady used to get on the tram with a big sack of mail, and obviously being U-boat men, we on our uniform, we had a the sort of sign with U-boat on it, you say, so they knew we were U-boat people. Anyway, so this lady, she got into a sack and gave us each a whole stack of letters. They were just addressed to a U-boat man. Oh, that's all it said. The girls were keen on U-boat men, you see. So with a stack of those letters, and that, so you open them, some of them had photographs in, and you, some of them you answered, did you like the look of them? Well, she didn't. I quite enjoyed that time there.
So were the U-boat men glamour boys in a sense?
Very much so. Very much so. In fact, I go as far as to say U-boat men in Bremen, it was a Navy station, so you had all sorts there. But the U-boat men were literally hated by the rest of the services. Simply because they were treated differently, U-boat men. We used to get, for instance, 40 cigarettes a day in our ration. But the rest of them got 3 a day. Air Force and Army got 3 a day. We got 40 a day. So that we got chocolate. We got wine and liqueurs. We got everything. So, of course, there was always this rift between the U-boat men. When we went out on the town, there was always, to put it bluntly, a punch-up between the U-boat men and the other forces.
Did you ever get involved in the punch-ups yourself?
Yes.
What exactly happened?
Well, we just walked into this, what we then called a cafe, and there were naval personnel in there, Air Force personnel, And the first thing they shouted at us, here come the plutocrats. Well, we didn't like that. We retaliated and developed into a free-for-all. So, you know, chairs flying around and the military police turning up. Again, they were prejudiced in themselves because the military police turned up, arrested a lot of people, amongst others, U-boat men, but U-boat men were always released. Air Force, Army, they stayed in for some reason. That went.
So it wasn't just the rest of the Kriegsmarine that hated you, it was the other services as well.
Oh, yes. It was simply because it was... Well, it is now, looking back on it, it's understandable. We used to get all those privileges. Chocolate and booze and cigarettes. They got none of it. Well, very little of it. So we were called the plutocrats. And that was it. So every time we went on the town, we had to go in groups. Because if you went on your own, you come back with a black eye. At least. So it worked out. Mind you, the ladies liked it. When the ladies saw us coming with our little medallion on there, U-boat medallion, and that's it. They didn't want to know the other forces. That's why this sort of almost hatred developed, you see. Because we were given so many privileges.
So what boat did you go to first of all?
What boat?
Yes.
The first... What was the first number? I can't remember. It was a very low number, 28, I believe. I finished up on a boat 187. That's the one I remember vividly. It was the last one, 187.
Why did you go to a low number? Was this a clapped-out boat?
It was one of the first ones, 250 tons, the smallest one. And you could say it was a question of being trained as a U-boat man. It's quite complicated. It really is. Thinking back, looking back now, I'm terrified. When I think back about it now, I'm terrified. Still am. I don't know if you've ever been on a submarine, and especially on a U-boat. I've been on an English submarine, which compared to a German U-boat, is like a five-star hotel. The British one, compared to a German U-boat.
In what way?
For a start, British submarines had two decks, ratings, officers, and everything was rosewood and, it was really what I call posh. Everything was smart in it. Everything was there for the comfort of the crew. Rightly so, I might add. But in a German submarine, it was very basic. Everything was solid metal. There was no trimmings of any kind. In fact, on a German submarine, when you went out on a trip and you were loaded with torpedoes, which we took 30 torpedoes with us, you had to sleep standing up in a corner, wedged between pipes of some description or other, and you sort of wedged yourself in and you took a nap until some of the torpedoes which hung in your quarters, so you couldn't get the bunks down. The bunks had to be folded back to the hull. The bunks had to be folded back to the hull to get the torpedoes in. And until they were used up, there were 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 of them in the quarters, the ratings quarters. Until they were shot or whatever, you just couldn't go to your bunk. You just stood in the corner somewhere or wherever you could. You took a nap. Where the British submarines, they had their bunks. They crawled in their bunks and snored their head off. We couldn't do that. You took a cat nap. Simple as that. Water dripping everywhere because everything was metal.
So it must have meant that there was every incentive for the crew to fire their torpedoes as soon as possible.
You could say that. You could say that, yes. But then it wasn't quite so easy because the captain he wasn't at liberty to just shoot things about as he pleased, because one of those torpedoes was then valued at 300,000 German marks, each torpedo, so they were expensive items, expensive toys, you might say. So he had to fill in detailed forms every time he shot one of those things. Captain had to fill in detailed forms of the target and this and the other. I mean, I don't know all the details, obviously, but it was quite not as easy as it sounds. He was being watched as well, the captain.
What was the air like in the submarine?
Terrible. Really terrible. When you were above, it wasn't so bad, because you had ventilators going, so you got some fresh air. And if your hatch was open, you obviously got fresh air. But underwater, considering the diesel engines were running all day long, when you then dived, you obviously switched them off, because you can't run diesels underwater. You had to switch them off and switch over to the electric motors. But the stench was there, the diesel stench. Everything was closed up, and you dived, and you had that diesel stench in the whole boat. It took some getting used to. It really was terrible, and I wasn't the only one being sick. A lot of people were.
What kind of sickness did you have? You mean vomiting?
Yes. Oh, yes, yes. Yeah, because of that diesel fumes, the stench in there.
Did your health suffer in any other ways?
Well, I got myself ulcers. I was put it down to that.
Stomach ulcers?
Yes. I put it down to that.
How old were you when you got those?
That was in Canada when I discovered them. I was in prisoner of war camp in Canada. I was then about 20, I would say.
Did you get headaches in the U-boat?
You did indeed. Headaches, sickness, seasickness, a lot of seasickness. Personally, I mean, I can't speak for other people, but personally, I was seasick solidly for 6 weeks. And it got to a stage where you said to yourself, why can't I die? You feel that bad. You really do. And you have to be on duty, mind you. Now, what I call my little cubbyhole, I was a wireless operator. My little cubbyhole was no more than perhaps a yard and a half square. That included all the equipment, the yard and a half. So by the time you take the equipment, transmitters, receivers into account, which were above, side, front, you had a tiny little desk. You sat in a chair, as I'm sitting now. Your legs were under the desk at far. To get out, you literally had to go up like this and get your legs out, then crawl over your chair to get out. You couldn't get in on the side. You had to crawl over the chair and let yourself down. That's all the room there was. The rest of it was all equipment all around you. You had a tiny little desk, and that was it.
What did you have in your working space?
Oh, in this transmitters, we had two transmitters with two receivers and the Aztec, the underwater listening device.
What were the main problems you had in doing the job?
As far as I'm concerned, the main problem was seasickness, which I didn't overcome until, that might raise a giggle now, until one old sea dog, he waited 6 ruddy weeks watching me being seasick. Never said a thing. Until he said, swallow a bit of bacon. On a bit of string, pull it up again.